Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the first of the year's shows for The Three Horsemen.
Yay.
Starring myself, Fred Kish, along with Jeff Patterson.
Hi there.
And John Hello. Stevens.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Hello.
Sorry for the gap in our schedule, but real life once again intervened. It just seems to keep coming at us faster and faster the older we get.
Yeah.
And as you all know, we are very old.
There'll be no arguments from us.
No arguments there. No. Tonight's show, we're going to split between two things. The first being we're going to talk a little bit about Catherine Moore, a author who wrote during the Golden Age all the way up to the 80s and who has had a big influence on the field. And then we will have our usual discussion of what we've all been spending our time and money on in terms of books, movies, television, or other things. So, gentlemen, how are you doing tonight?
I'm pretty good.
That being, of course, Jeff Patterson.
Hi, Jeff Patterson. I blog at Gravity Lens, which can be found at Bad Day Studio and is in severe need of an update. And I am Jeff Patterson 11 on Twitter.
And our other participant, of course, is John Stevens.
That's me. And I am, at the moment, I'm primarily a columnist for SF Signal. I have a woefully underutilized blog. I tend to hang out much more on Twitter and Facebook at the moment. But I am gearing up for, you know, a much more aggressive writing schedule in 2014, working on a couple of books and all that stuff, and reading a lot and writing a lot and raising a daughter and selling lots of books and astonishing Fred Kish with the books I have in my bookstore.
Well, usually the piles of books that you snap a picture of. I'm bringing these home tonight. And like, where do you find the time, John? Where
I got another one for you. I brought a big stack home tonight. So.
Oh, boy. And I'm trying to downsize my book collection. So we're definitely two worlds in collision here.
Yeah, over the holidays, the wife had a conversation with a friend of mine regarding moving a lot of volumes to ebooks, and she was looking at her massive Turtle Dove collection and a few other things, saying, you know, if I had these on an e-reader, I could put other things on this shelf. And so
that's the problem. You get rid of one and you pick up 10 others.
Right. Well, she also has lots of tchotchkes that she wants to put on display as well, and I think that's the motivating factor here.
You just got to dust those.
Yeah.
So for tonight, we're going to talk about Catherine Lucille Moore, who is probably more known, if you know her at all, by the initials C.L. Moore, because she wrote way back in the dawn of time, mostly for the pulps, where unfortunately not too many women wrote. So a lot of women took, if they were active in the field, would change their names or otherwise hide the name so that it was not as apparent that they were women. But Catherine Moore is definitely that would stick out under any pseudonym. And as we'll see, she did use quite a few pseudonyms. She was born in 1911, lived until 1987, and is one of the interesting things I always found was that she was married to a writer, Henry Kuttner. So she's very similar to another couple in the field, Leigh Brackett and Edmund Hamilton. But what was really interesting always to me about Moore and Kuttner is that they could often, one would start a story, type a bit, get up and walk away from the typewriter. The other person would walk through the room, read what was being written, sit down, and continue the story. And they worked so well together that I find it difficult to determine which person wrote which part of what story. Mm-hmm. Kuttner is noted as introducing himself to C.L. Moore, thinking that she was a man, writing her a fan letter, and not being driven away by the fact that she was a woman. Eventually they got married and, you know, started writing together or writing separately. They wrote both for Weird Tales, They also wrote a lot for Astounding Science Fiction. Some of the better stories that they've written, either separately or together, were a couple of stories set on Venus, Clash by Night and Fury, a story that I'll bet a lot of our listeners have read or seen, unfortunately, on the film, Mimsy Wore the Borogroves, a haunting time travel story called Vintage Season, and, of course, the ones that I'm going to talk about tonight, The Tales of Northwest of Earth and The Tales of Juriel of Joyrie. Any contributions so far from you gentlemen?
Well, it's really funny.
Oh,
we're going to talk at the same time.
Go ahead, John.
When I say that name in my head, I say Juriel of Joyrie for some reason. Isn't that bizarre?
Is
there an official pronunciation? Do we know of one?
I would guess that since it's supposed to be a mythical part of France, that it's probably pronounced however you would pronounce something similar in French, but me being the lousy linguist that I am, you know, I'm just going by what I've always said all these years.
Right. No, and as someone who speaks French, that's probably why I'd...
There you go. Okay.
I did a little francophone in there.
We will defer to you
on that.
Yes,
I just love the way that rolls off the tongue. It's like, I'm Juriel of Joyrie.
Yeah. You'll have to overcome 50 years of habit for me, so.
Yeah.
Might take a few.
I think we should each do it in our own special way.
I pronounce it with all silent J's. The thing I'd like to throw into your intro there, Fred, though, is I got introduced to Moore and Leigh Brackett and several other writers through the Del Rey Best Of Collections.
Ah, yes. Yep.
In the 70s and early 80s, which a great deal of praise has to be retroactively placed on Mr. Del Rey for getting those published, because I remember seeing the Del Rey catalog, I think, in 78, and just flipping through all the books and going, these are all authors I've never heard of before, or I've seen their names in articles or mentions in old magazines, and some I recognized from old covers of Weird Tales and Planet Stories and stuff like that. But those Del Rey volumes that came out were really a reintroduction of a lot of real classic stuff in the 70s, mm-hmm. and once again in the wake of Star Wars coming out in 77, there was such a market for SF at the time. And the other thing that Del Rey did, which really got eyes into these stories, was the fact that he commissioned such great paintings for the covers. And the Best of C.L. Moore has the classic cover with the robot in the evening gown coming down the stairs, which is such a graceful yet somewhat disconcerting image. That was one of the things that really got a lot of people to pick that book up and go into it.
Well, I was going to bring that up later because...
Oh.
I mean, and actually asked John if he thought that...
Nice, Jeff.
That's... No. That series and that story, I mean, that series also had a entry by Cort Wayner Smith.
Oh, yes.
Which collected a lot of the short stories together and gave us a nice introduction by John J. Pierce and even a timeline. But one of the stories that Smith wrote featured a dancing cyborg. And I always wondered if he had been influenced by C.L. Moore. I think it's the story Not Rogov.
Yes.
Where he sees the vision of the future at the dance competition.
Ooh.
So who knows? My first introduction to Moore was not those books, but a little earlier. My library had a book called Chamblou and Others from Gnome Press. A beautiful copy in the library, and I actually found a beautiful copy myself, and that has a mixture of both the fantasy stories and the Northwest of Smith Northwest of Earth stories. So I got a nice solid grounding of a half dozen stories early on in my reading career. and stuck with me ever since. So would we like to talk a little bit about particular stories or any more background?
I mean, I'll throw in my background because it's pretty simple. My I actually was directed towards her by in high school by my my history teacher, who was the person who actually introduced me to science fiction and whose library I raided for about 3.5 years.
Is this the gentleman who gave you Nova?
Yes, exactly. Uh-huh. The same.
So we're going to hear a lot about this person.
Yeah.
Over the many episodes. The
very, very formative person. But I came into school with a Conan paperback. I believe like it was like a Lynn Carter Conan collection or L. Sprague de Camp or something. And he looked at it with utter disdain. And he said, "Why are you reading that?" And I believe I said something about as, you know, nonsensical as, "Because I like Conan." And he said, "There's much better stuff to read than that." And he, I remember this very clearly because he gave me Fritz Lieber, C.L. Moore, and then he actually gave me a different L. Sprague de Camp book to read. I think the what's it called now? The Incomplete Enchanter?
Right. Yeah.
Is that, they read that with Fletcher Pratt, or was that his own thing?
That was Fletcher Pratt.
That's Fletcher Pratt. Okay.
The stories of Harold Shea.
Okay.
The Mathematics of Magic, Castle of Iron, the Roaring Trumpet.
Right. So he gave me a stack of those to read, and I liked that stuff. That was okay. The Fafnir and the Grey Mouser stuff was just fantastic, and the real eye opener really ended up being the Joelle Rory stories, because my 15-year-old mind had not been able to comprehend that a woman could be, a sword swinging, a sword swinging fighter type, in the vein of Conan, but with a lot of extra stuff that I hadn't considered at that point. It was possible to have in those stories. There's emotion, there's tension. I mean, in a Conan story, there's not a huge amount of tension. You're not exactly expecting Conan to die or to go through some profound change necessarily, even though he occasionally did in stories. But they were really a different way of taking that basic kind of adventure sword and sorcery story and doing something, much more interesting with it in terms of what the characters were like and what the situations signified. I mean, what Howard often hinted at in terms of, tension or horrors in his stories seemed to come out much more in more. So that was how I got into her work. I didn't read any of the Northwest Smith stuff until much, much later. And I think I'm still woefully undereducated in Moore's work, because I've looked at some of the bibliographies, and she was much more prolific both with Kuttner and on her own than I had really thought until actually quite recently. So I was very eager to talk about her work tonight, because she's not necessarily forgotten, but I think she's still very underappreciated, and it's interesting to go back to that stories of that time and find something that wasn't the same as a lot of the other stuff that really stood out as more vibrant and also in some cases more disturbing than a lot of the other work that was being produced.
Well, what was the quote that you found earlier today? Mm. And that's a
yeah, quote. That was from the introduction to The Best of C.L. Moore, and that was from Lester Del Rey. And I love that quote because it's not denigrating of the readers, but it was just a really interesting way to characterize the combination of sort of freshness that sort of emerged with her work, but also the fact that it resonated with readers. Like, readers weren't, somehow turned off by the somewhat different kind of stuff that she was writing. They actually seemed to really embrace it and enjoy it. And that's that's really what struck me about that quote, and I'm actually looking for it now as I yammer here. Here it is. So, Lester L. Wright said in his intro to The Best of C.L. Moore, every male reader, this is about Chamblot, her first story, every male reader loved the story, forgot his chauvinism, and demanded more stories about, this is not about Chamblot. I apologize. This is about Black God's Kiss.
Right.
Because he's demanding more stories about Sherelle. He talks about Chamblot in the beginning of the introduction, because he opens by talking about a reading she gave of Chamblot. Then he goes into more deeply what she wrote and how people received her. And like I said, I like that quote, not just because of the idea of, you know, male readers being sort of somehow startled out of a certain complacency, but because it means concurrently that the writing was very interesting to them and there was something they wanted to hear more of. And the interesting thing, one of the interesting things about Moore to me is that, like I said, there's this really interesting mixture of very standard pulp stuff, but often there's sometimes a disturbing and sometimes a rather kind of visceral, empathic play of emotions going on underneath the stories.
Well,
go ahead.
No, I was going to say Northwest Smith, or Northwest of Earth. I mean, he could be Han Solo, or that sort of pulp character. But mm-hmm. some of the encounters he has, like of course, Chamblot, mm-hmm. and we're going to have to say we're going to spoil some of these stories for you folks. But you know, I think the statute
of limitations
is well expired on a story from the 1930s, but Northwest of Earth in Chamblot encounters what is basically the Medusa, a sort of vampire with snakes for hair who feeds off his life force. In another story, Black Thirst, he encounters a primeval being in Venus who raises women to be more and more beautiful and who then feeds off the essence of their beauty. And then there's other stories, the Tree of Life, where they all seem to be vampires if you look at it one way, but there's a creature in another dimension that feeds off of the people in that dimension, or I think it's the Scarlet Dream. You know, it's all these. I mean, Leigh Brackett, as much as I like Leigh Brackett, a lot of her stories could have just been, you take the blasters, you substitute the six guns again, it's just another Western.
Mm-hmm.
But C.L. Moore really had, either in the terms of her descriptions or her settings or her creatures, something that just really, like, made you think, this is not normal. I mean, in Black God's mm-hmm. Kiss, Jirelle goes to the base of her castle to seek out a way of getting back at the guy who's invaded her castle. And she goes down to hell. But that journey down to hell is just so creepy, and the journey through hell is creepy, because it's like, whoa, you know, who built this tunnel down to hell, and you know, why is she so afraid of daylight coming in hell and things like that?
Well, and her response is not just like, you know, the Conan response of, oh, by Crom, I will overcome all. there's more layering to her character and to the way that she responds to things. And, you know, she feels afraid sometimes. She feels apprehensive sometimes. She feels, you know, as strongly, if not more strongly determined than Conan could ever be sometimes. But that interaction, that undertone that you're talking about, I see in almost all the work of hers that I've read.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that we would probably call today Lovecraftian, but that wasn't really what it was back then.
Mm.
Even though she was someone who interacted with Lovecraft and sort of knew his work and he knew hers, that really wasn't what it was. It was an iteration of sort of weird fiction. I guess what we would call weird fiction now.
Well,
but she But she blended it. She blended it with science fiction, science fantasy, planetary romance. She really did some pretty interesting, you know, genre mashups, essentially.
Right.
Well before the time when people thought about that kind of idea.
Well, I mean, I think as much as Lovecraft may or may not have influenced her, I see a lot of Clark Ashton Smith in her work.
Yeah. Mm.
And I also see a lot of Abraham Murrett, who is another one that's kind of been forgotten today, but was a major influence on a lot of people. With, he wrote Lost Race stories. He wrote stories with secret societies, Castaways, science fiction, all sorts of stuff. And a very, very, very similar feel of the atmosphere just soaking through the story, like C.L. Moore did, or Smith.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, something that hearing you guys talk about the undertones and the subtext of the more fantastic elements of the story, one of the things that was going through my mind was one of the things that really got me hooked on her stuff was the fact that all of these stories went to these really strange places and you were confronted with all these oddball entities, but the stories, even though they're fairly fast paced, they all start off with scenes or sequences which both A, convey the alienness of the setting, but also B, are a touch pedestrian. You know, it opens with the character standing on Mars, as opposed to a lot of, you know, early SF, which was all about how we got to the character standing on Mars. You know, it's a person's in a cave, or a person's in a city, or a person is, you know, doing an exchange with a seller, or walking through the marketplace, or something like this. And it's, even though it conveys a lot of the information about, yes, this is the alien setting that you're never ever going to see in your lifetime that this person is walking through, which by any account would be considered exotic, at the same time it's always the most mundane everyday activity that Smith is undergoing. he's trying to buy something, or he's trying to relax, or he's trying to, you know,
close the deal,
go about his day, and then suddenly he gets confronted with these alien horrors or strange super beings, etc. And I always love the way those opens always kind of trickle into to those lovely second acts, which really expand everything.
I mean, she was also great with her descriptive stuff. Like, for example, this is from Shamblou. Then into his range of vision flashed a red running figure, dodging like a hunted hare from shelter to shelter in the narrow street. It was a girl, a burry brown girl in a single tattered garment whose scarlet burnt the eyes with its brilliance. I mean, she really just worked in the colors and, you know, it's always, you know, the textures and the food. Yeah, wonderful stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, her writing style sometimes goes over into sort of
purple.
Excessive pulpy. Yeah, there you go. Excessive. I was going to say excessive pulpiness, but, you know, purple works too. You know, and there are occasions and there are occasional passages where you're kind of like, yep, okay, yep. Okay, it's really creepy. Okay, it's really creepy.
But the
vividness is really the payoff. When the passages work, they're vivid. Mm-hmm. And they add to the combination of the sense of disquiet and immediacy that I find in most of the stuff of hers that I've read.
I think she was much better than others of the era as far as description. You know, how many unspeakable horrors did we come across in Lovecraft?
Right. Right.
I mean, I adore Lovecraft's writings and whatever, you know, they're still among my favorites, but Moore clearly had a lot more talent. Sorry, more talent, yeah. Than he did. Right. I'm sure we'll be doing that a lot.
No, see, I like her in some way, in a number of ways, more than Lovecraft. Because I think her command of language and just her sheer sort of writing ability was much stronger. You can argue that there was sort of more philosophical, you know, wonkiness to Lovecraft, and he could generate certain sensations much more.
Just wonkiness.
Well, the other,
but like you said with that description of from the opening of Chamblot, or like in the Tree of Life, like I love the first line of the Tree of Life, which is, "Over time ruined Illar, the searching plane swooped and circled. Northwest Smith, peering up at them with a steel pale stare from the shelter of a half collapsed temple, thought of vultures wheeling above Carrion." That's the first two sentences, but whatever. Mm. It's just a boom. She's not only established this very science fiction-y moment where these searching planes looking for him, but he's in like a half collapsed temple, and there's this, you know, the metaphor of the vultures, and why, you know, and all these questions pop up in your head. You're like, why is he standing in a, what's a time, you know, a time ruined temple, and you know, I mean, it's just it, the immediacy is not like that of, say, like a Tom Clancy thriller, which is a very sort of realist kind of immediacy. There's an immediacy that comes out of the tone and out of the sort of the richness of the both the emotion and the sort of sensation of being there that she wants to generate.
Right.
And the other thing that I would say, if you're, you know, drawing, you know, comparisons and contrasts with Lovecraft, is that I also think that she was a bit more successful at the premise of building a mythos than Lovecraft was. I've always felt that Lovecraft's mechanics when it came to building a mythos was to just keep adding to it, and, you know, not necessarily ever give it a point, but, you know, keep adding complexity to it and stuff like that. Wherein her view of you know, life in the solar system and the various things that dwell there and everything that happened before man, the whole idea of you know, there having been another generation of man before ours and stuff like that, really played in. And it was, even though she and other writers of that time, you know, probably did not feel the pressure to be hyper-conscious of their continuity because they didn't have to deal with the fanboy storm of the modern world, I think that it's pretty cohesive, and there's never any really major contradictions that one comes across in it. And it's quite nice in the fact that as you get to each story, the weight of that story increases, you know, with the passing of all the stories that have gone on before it. So,
yeah. But also, one of Lovecraft's goals was to create unknowability.
That's true.
And that's not Moore's task at all. She wants you to feel what's going on. She wants you to understand what the characters are going through. And she even wants you to understand what, you know, sometimes what the monsters are going through, essentially, right? Mm-hmm. So she's coming at it from a different angle. So I think, in part, the consistency just may arise from the way that she... From the goal of what she's trying to accomplish with the story itself, because Lovecraft's not as interested in some sort of continuity, or, you know, or even explicit, you know, detailed mythos building, as he wants to create these things that are terrible and unknowing and that embody, you know, existential anxieties. Mm-hmm. And Moore is not as interested, I think, in that as in looking for terrors that hit a little closer to home.
Right.
Like the way she describes how Smith feels in Chamblot, with the nightmares when he first encounters the Chamblot. It's not sort of Lovecraftian ungraspable madness.
Yeah.
It's very much like, I feel like I'm losing myself.
Right. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Which I think is actually a big theme in Moore overall, is preservation and, you know, sort of defense of the self.
Oh yeah, Lovecraft did a, you know, he built a malignant universe. I'd say the Northwest stories are certainly a much more of a benevolent universe, just full of a lot of really creepy stuff.
Right. No, I think that characterizes
the garden is beautiful, but there are slugs in it. So,
or or grass that sucks your blood.
Uh-huh.
God, that creeped me out. So many things creep me out in these stories. Well, anything else we want to talk about here for more, or move on to our second half?
Well, you mentioned the you mentioned the various editions and how complete they are.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
What is your recommendation for definitive editions?
Well, we will, of course, include links.
Mm-hmm.
And several years ago, a series was launched called Planet Stories from Paizo Publishing. And if you can find them, and they're, if you're patient, you can find them. There's two editions. One called Black God's Kiss has all of the Jor-El stories in it. And the second one is Northwest of Earth, which has all of the Northwest Smith stories in it. And each of them has one story overlapping, which is a Quest of the Star Stone, in which both Northwest and Jor-El meet. Now, that's a collaboration, an open collaboration between herself and Henry Kuttner, which I'm not, you know, it's not one of the better ones, but it's still fun. In fact, I think that the weakest stories in either collection are the ones that are the open collaborations. There's also a collaboration with Forrest J. Ackerman, which is kind of route and doesn't have the same zing and the same atmosphere. So, que sera, sera. There is an ebook edition of Northwest of Earth, which is very reasonably priced.
I was just about to say that. I actually saw that today when I was looking around. Yeah.
Yep. But unfortunately, it's only got about half the stories as this Paizo Publications. And there are a couple of stories, if you look, like on Gutenberg, some of the stories are out of copyright and are available.
Mm-hmm.
So you can at least get a taste. And there are some good ebook editions, like the Baldy stories, which are credited to Kuttner, but probably were collaborations, are available. And there is, I think, one of the other fix-ups is available as an ebook. I can't remember which one, whether it's Judgment Night. But there are several.
Yeah, Judgment Night is, yeah.
Okay, right. That's the one. Probably also Singularity Company. So you can get a good taste of her writings if you hunt around a bit and don't mind being a little patient finding some of the collections.
You can also get The Challenge from Beyond quite cheaply as a...
Yes. But that there's a reason that one's pretty cheap. Would you like to describe that one, John?
Do I have to? The Challenge from Beyond is this... it's almost like a serial collaboration.
Well, you know, before there were shared worlds. Yeah.
Right. So, five authors. It's Lovecraft, Howard Moore, Merritt, and Frank Belknap Long. Basically, each wrote a short chapter of this bizarre story about someone I always think of as like a sleepy guy, because they talk about him being sleepy, it seems, so often.
Well, you had a major clash, though, things like the Lovecraftian chapter. The guy, of course, goes insane with his super science. That's or whatever. Right. But then when you get to the Howard chapter, he, like, you know, bursts out of his bonds and slews the overlord and takes over the planet. And it's right. Like, what?
It's, yeah, I mean, it's really kind of an insane story.
Yes.
If you try to look at it as a story, as an all-in-one story. And it literally is. Each of them were like, I'm going to do this now. The hell with the rest of you. I only found out about it like last week. And then I saw the cheap edition and picked it up and read it on in Kindle form. And it is. It's crazy. It's not a story, really. It's like these five people each saying, you know, I'm going to talk a little bit about this guy in my own way. And I don't really care what the rest of you have really done.
And then I'm going to do my story the way I want to.
Exactly.
The way I do all my stories.
Exactly. But it's interesting to see the different styles at play. I mean, it's really funny to like read, you know, Moore opens it, and is it Howard or is it Long that finishes it?
I don't remember. It's been a while.
I'm flipping through it now. I think it's Long. If Long finishes it, and his is actually the shortest. His is like maybe a page and a half of actual, you know, book text. And that's when, spoiler alert, George Campbell becomes a terrible, you know, creature. but each of them sort of put their stamp on the story in a way that just sort of accentuates something about almost their writerly persona. And that was sort of the most interesting thing about it to me to read. It was not the story itself, which wasn't that good, but to see each of them sort of take their own way of telling a story and what they like to do with a story and apply it to this sort of template. It's certainly not one of Moore's best efforts either. But nope. It was interesting to read, and certainly for the price, it was worth to sort of experience it.
I mean, it was the editor had an idea, and well, probably didn't quite think it through or give enough guidance.
No, it really does read as if they just like did their own thing, and someone put them all together in a row. And
I mean, if you look at stuff today, there are a lot of good shared world series out there, Wild Cards or. Mm-hmm. Heroes in Hell, or there was a good Ellison shared world, there was a good Silverberg shared world, and so on and so forth.
The first Liavec volume was good too.
Yes, that's a good series.
Yeah, that was a good series. Thieves World, obviously.
Right.
Wasn't that a Metropolis that came out a few years ago?
Yep.
That's one of the more recent ones. Example. Yep.
So, it you know, it's notable for being a pioneer. And we'll leave it at that. Well, yeah. we will provide links to the various collections as well as some background. We'll also provide links to an article by Andrew Liptak on Moore and an article by our own Paul Weimer on Moore, as well as some other things. For example, current author Lavi Tidhar has written recently a couple of stories that are definitely influenced by Moore. We'll provide links to all that stuff. So now on to the second half of our show for the evening. What have we all been doing since our last episode? Who would like to talk about their stuff first?
I can go.
Okay.
Just before we started recording, I just finished the Robert Reed story in the January-February fantasy and science fiction called We Don't Mean to Be, and it was very good. Reed is one of those authors who just never, ever lets me down, regardless of the length, regardless of the setting or subject matter.
Is this one of his the ship stories?
No.
Okay.
It was not. Two things I got over Christmas. I got the Old Mars anthology, and I got the Peter Watts Beyond the Rift, and I have been devouring those two with great relish. Two other books I got on art. I picked up, and I'm sort of reading them side by side because they're a very interesting contrast. The first one has the very nonchalant title "How to Draw" by Scott Robertson and Thomas Bertling. This is a book basically on drawing forms and hardware. And really getting into the line work, and there's also quite a bit of composition involved. Especially, it talks at length about the importance of things like perspective and composition when you're dealing with drawing technology. And a lot of what's in there is applicable to both pencil and pen drawing and drawing digitally. And it's got a lot of really good deconstructed eye candy on how to make interesting shapes and forms and stuff like that. Scott Robertson's actually been a regular name on quite a few books on art that I've gotten recently on technique, and especially on forms and building big, impressive machines. The other book that I've really been enjoying is just called Sci-Fi, and it was put out by the magazine Imagine FX, which is a digital art magazine for Photoshop and Illustrator artists, and which very recently started incorporating a section in the back called Fantasy Illustrator, which is primarily for what they call conventional art. It is a strictly non-digital medium section that has already featured like Tom Kidd and stuff like that. But anyways, this book that came out is primarily about drawing science fiction subject matter via technology, via, you know, digitally composing these things and mastering them. And a lot of it really gets into the granular detail on doing highlights and doing light sources and stuff like that. But once again, it's one of those books that inspires you by giving you some really nice material to look at. It shows you the, you know, the finished image of a, you know, oversized space battle or a giant hulking machine or something like that. And then in the pages that follow, it actually shows you how these things were built up, how shapes were created, how layers were done, how surfaces were rendered and mapped and stuff like that. So those two books have been next to me on the couch. Two comics I want to mention. The first one is called Legendary, with a little bit of a weird spelling, L-E-G-E-N-D-E-R-R-Y. Legendary is the town in this steampunk comic, which features steampunk versions of Vampirella and the Green Hornet. This is the first issue came out, I believe, the week after Christmas, and it is a gorgeous piece of work. I have a bit of a love-hate relationship with attempts to do steampunk in comics because, for the most part, it really tries to push the aesthetic over the story. Bill Willingham is writing this. I am a huge fan of his from his work on Fables, and he is definitely bringing his A game to this particular comic, at least this first issue. It's also kind of interesting to Vampirella in a steampunk setting isn't that big of a leap. Green Hornet kind of is, and the fact that he makes it work as well as he does is pretty good. There's been a lot of you know, mashup books like this. There was a book called Masks that was done a while ago, which was Green Hornet meets the Shadow and several other masked people from various pulps, the Spider and stuff like that. That was a rather intriguing book, but that seemed to be, hey, how much can we throw into this? This does seem to have a very coherent story that they're working on. And I'm going to end on a down note because we just wrapped up issue 4 of Jeff Darrow's Revisiting Shaolin Cowboy. Shaolin Cowboy was a book that he did for the brief-lived imprint Bully Comics. And Jeff Darrow, who did stuff like Big Guy and Rusty and Hard Boiled and a few other books, if you've ever seen his stuff is just meticulous. His line work is insane. You can look at his stuff literally for hours. And when he did Shaolin Cowboy originally, it was this very surrealist adventure book about this usually silent, very seldom does he say anything, monk with a sword on his riding on his donkey through a post-apocalyptic landscape and coming across just very surrealist adventures. It sometimes read more like an issue of Flaming Carrot than any kind of a post-apocalyptic story. And his initial run on it was spectacular. It really needs to be reprinted in an oversized edition because his art was just so, you know, he hand draws every, you know, the texture of everything, you know, and there's always massive temples and huge monsters and amazing battle sequences and stuff like this. So I was very excited that he was bringing Shaolin Cowboy back for 4 issues. Unfortunately, the first issue was a very intriguing setup, and the next 3 issues are basically a sequence of two-page spreads. Each spread is split into two strips, a top and bottom, illustrating scenes from the same fight. He's fighting a bunch of zombies with various weapons that he pulls out. And it's very sequential, and the story, you know, it follows along, an actual choreographed fight scene. But it's three issues of the same fight scene. Don't get me wrong, it's beautiful. I've been staring at the art like crazy, but I was expecting a little more of the madness that he brought in the original book. I recommend it if you love looking at beautiful art, but quite frankly, I would wait for the trade, and on top of that, I'd wait till you find the trade used, to be honest with you.
Uh-oh. Well.
That's all okay. I got.
Oh, alrighty. Me, huh?
Well, I can go.
I'm going. I haven't done a huge amount.
Like I said, I've got notes.
I understand. Then you'll bad cleanup there, Fred. I haven't done a huge amount of reading or culture consuming, unless you count a lot of Dr. Seuss books.
I do, in fact.
Reading with the child. I think at this point I could probably write a piece on, you know, watching someone experience the Dr. Seuss books for the first time. And she's 4 and a half, and she's actually starting to read. And we actually read, we've read little bits of Green Eggs and Ham and another not Seuss book called Snug House, Bug House. But anyway, so that aside, I went back over the holidays to comics, actually, and read a few graphic novels. Stuff that I hadn't read before. It's not all recent stuff, but one thing was something I had not read before, but I was drawn to because of the artist, and that's Matt Fraction and Mike Allred's Fantastic Faux, F-A-U-X. I read the first volume of that. And, you know, Allred cannot not make something really weird and freaky. And he totally does that with the art. The story wasn't the best for me. I'm actually not a huge Matt Fraction fan. I find his output to be kind of uneven. And this was sort of middle-of-the-road Fraction to me. There were some moments that could have been compelling that just were sort of like, oh, okay. Because what's funny about this is the first volume of a multi-volume run. This is the story of the Fantastic Four disappearing and being replaced by Ant-Man, She-Hulk, Medusa, and someone called Miss Thing, who appears to be a pop star who has a Thing costume. I think that's what it is.
That's exactly what it is.
And I had never encountered this particular person before. But what they're actually doing is something more akin to sort of running, you know, Xavier School for Gifted Youngsters, sort of Fantastic Four style, and including, like, you know, mole children from the Mole Man's underworld and inhuman children and stuff like that. So there were so many great little moments in the art, and there were some really potentially interesting moments in the story, and then they would just seem to kind of lose steam. So I kind of liked it. I'd like to probably find at least the next volume and see how it is, but that wasn't the favorite thing that I really had read this time around. I also went back and reread something I'd read before, which was the Alan Moore DC Universe volume, which has all of his various stories. Because I'm reading his biography at the moment for review at SF Signal, and it was a lot of fun to go back and read his stories from the days when he actually liked comics, or at least appeared to. Because Moore's best comic stories aren't just really good comic stories, they're really well-done stories. And you really see him trying to not just kind of push the envelope so much as figure out, is there something different I can say with this story? Can I do something a little different to the character, or to the trope, or the plot? And when it succeeds, it's really a pleasure to really a pleasure to see. So it was a lot of fun to go back and look over that. And then, as I said, I hate to say it, I'm slogging through Magic Words, The Extraordinary Life of Alan Moore by Lance Parkin, which is a biography of Moore. And it's kind of interesting so far. I'm kind of waiting for it to pick up. But what I think what's dragging me down is what often drags me down about a lot of books about literary figures is that the people who often write the books about them are fans of their writing. And that enthusiasm, while it can be useful for examining the author's relationship to the material, almost seems to inevitably color, not negatively, but distractingly, the way that they approach their life. So you get a very clear sense early on in Magic Words that Alan Moore is really awesome and cool and extraordinary. And, you know, what I'd like to read is the actual story of how that happened and how it occurs and how Moore himself thinks of that characterization. And I haven't gotten there yet. I'm not sure if I'm going to. So I'm hoping it's good. It's decently written, although it feels a little fanish in its execution.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are biographies that try to be very historically detailed or discerning, and some that try to cultivate some kind of distance between the reader and the author. But this is obviously someone who really admires Moore a lot, and the writing style gets a little casual, which isn't bad in of itself, but if it's a casual that illuminates how the author affects the reader and the writer of the book, that's one thing. But just sort of casual in a sense of, oh, hey, I like this guy so much, and I'm going to tell you in ways that I maybe haven't examined fully. When you get that impression, it's not as interesting a read.
If I could throw one thing out there, I'd recommend for you, as a follow-up to that, George Corey did a book, Extraordinary Works of Alan Moore. I want to say it came out maybe 10 years ago or so, which really goes through a lot of his works, but you get a lot of Moore's input into how he developed different types of narrative and how he developed, you know, storytelling techniques that were really unusual.
That sounds very interesting, actually. And I thought I would see, maybe I will see some of that later in this book. But that sounds like something that would be really interesting to read, almost in relation to this book and ponder. So cool. And that's sort of the stuff that I've read. I haven't seen a lot of other like genre movies or anything. So that's pretty much my little cultural input for this session.
Okay. Well, I've got a mixed bag, as usual. I'll just start out by extending it beyond me to my family. And I started rereading Roadside Picnic. So in the process of that, I started to rewatch Stalker, the movie, based on Roadside Picnic. And my wife came in about a half an hour from the end, and it was pretty much like, what's going on? Well, it's a Russian movie. It's long, complicated, and depressing, and it would take too long to explain. So when I was done watching that, I put on the remake of Solaris. So she watched that, and she's like at the end, well, that was interesting, but it couldn't have done very well in the theater because nothing blew up. I'm like, well, yeah, that's pretty much what happened. So that was watching some movies with my wife. Now, my daughter, after having it sit for several years on her shelf, read or is almost finished reading Dracula this week because she saw a play version of it at school last week. So I'm like, well, you know, you've got it on your shelf. She started reading it. And then Monday night I went out while I was waiting for her to finish her theater class. I bought her the first volume of the manga version of Gail Carriger's Paracel Protectorate stories. Gave it to her in the car, and by the time we drove home, I'm like, well, do you like it? Sort of. Are you going to keep reading it? Yeah, I want to find out what happens. And 2 days later, she was rereading it again and asked me to get the rest of it. And when my wife asked her, well, you're reading that and you're reading Dracula, are you going to read Twilight now? And her response was something along the lines of, no, these are proper British vampires, not silly American vampires.
Yeah.
That's great.
Now, I will include a link in the show notes of a site that I showed to Jeff and a few other people on Tumblr called Comic Cartography, which is just full of all sorts of wonderful maps of buildings and locations and all sorts of series. If you ever want to know what so-and-so's secret lair looks like, this is the site to look for it. So I've been exploring that. That's been fun. Mr. Postman brought me a couple of books, one of which was The Anubis Gates by Tim Powers, a very, very special edition from Centipede Press. And if you know Centipede Press, you know they're not cheap. But man, this book was worth skipping a lot of lunches for. It's humongous. It's illustrated. It has a separate book of the illustrations. It has a fold-out map of London. It's just Centipede Press. I mean, I'll never give up all physical books as long as there are publishers like this around. And I'll include that as a link. And then another small press, Hafner Press, just came out with their two most recent volumes. They've been doing a lot of, they did Lay Bracket. They did some Henry Kuttner, speaking of Henry Kuttner and C.L. Moore. And lately they've been concentrating on Edmund Hamilton, coming out with his collected stories, but also his Captain Future stories. And man, those are some funky pulp, speaking of pulp. Nonfiction, I'm reading a book called Reading Herodotus, A Guided Tour Through the Wild Boars, Dancing Suitors, and Crazy Tyrants of, quote, the History, unquote, by Deborah Hamill. And this is the kind of nonfiction I like to read where you can just pull a lot of ideas out for science fiction or fantasy or role-playing games or whatever. And to finish up my notable reads for 2013, I read 3 Samuel R. Delaney books, one of which, of course, I read 3 times, that being Nova. But the other 2 were 2 of his nonfiction collections, The Jewel Hinge Jaw and Starboard Wine. And both of those I'm going to have to read once or twice more before I really think I get a handle on Delaney, because he's just so dense in those books. Mm-hmm. I also greatly enjoyed Neil Gaiman's book, The Ocean at the End of the Lane, which felt to me to be very much like a M.R. James horror story. I read, again, a collection called Ghost Light by Fritz Leiber, which has, like, for example, 1 Fafford and Grey Mouser story and, you know, various other entries, a lot of his famous stuff. But that's about half the book is actually a autobiography. So that's a really good collection if you can ever find it, especially in the trade paperback edition, because it also has some wonderful illustrations in it. And to finish off, the best reads of what I had last year were a short work by Tim Powers called Salvage and Demolition, and Jack Vance's classic Dying Earth. I read that again. I think I read that every couple of years because they're just so wonderful little stories. And that's what I've done since last episode, folks.
Wow.
Yeah. What the hell have I been doing since
then? I know, man. Way to give a superiority complex, man.
Well, I mean, one thing I've mentioned, you know, I got through 105 books last year. And it's only because I've really discovered the sweet spot for maximizing my time. I mean, I drive a lot, unfortunately, so I'm listening to audiobooks. I carry my Kindle with me all the time, so if I'm standing in line at the post office, I pull it out and read a couple pages. And at home, I read paper books. I'm just, you know, not watching that much TV, not seeing that many movies, but I am trying to do as much reading as I can manage. Mm. And I still feel like I'm way far behind. Yeah. That's the scary part.
Yeah, no.
Yep. Well, gentlemen, any final thoughts before we all fade into our respective oblivions?
Wow.
Well, we've all had exciting weeks at work and home, and I think we need to get a, what is it, something to take care of our lumbago.
Yeah.
There you go.
I bought a lot of cheap bourbon down south this week, so I'll be
there you go.
I'll be self-medicating.
Okay.
No, I think we're good. I think we've been talking about some potential ideas for shows we're going to be doing in the months to come.
Yeah, I like the I really enjoyed doing the Delany and this podcast in terms of having a subject like that to toss around where we get to talk about some great old work and how it might be of interest to people to now as well. So, yeah, I think I'd like to do more of that certainly, and with a little more preparation than I had this time, perhaps. But but no, this was great. These conversations are really a lot of fun, and I often come away with some ideas too. So it's just kind of a bonus there.
Always good to remember that reading. Except for a very few people, reading is not a job.
Right.
Nope. It's fun.
We get as much out of it as we put into it. So.
That's true. So we hope you enjoyed our conversation tonight, folks, and we'll see you again, hopefully a little sooner than the December-January madness that we just experienced. So have a good night.
Good night.
Good night.